You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
What if the food on your plate could deliver a message more powerful than any policy memo? At the height of the Paris climate talk, Sam Cass served global leaders a quiet warning. Chocolate, wine, coffee, and even pasta, ingredients they love, are all at risk in a warming world. That dinner, cooked during COP21, wasn't just a meal. It was the beginning of a visceral movement he calls the Last Supper, a way to make climate change real, one course at a time. This is One Bite is Everything, the podcast that connects the food on our plate to the world around us through conversations with thought leaders across disciplines. I'm your host, Dana DePrima, and together we're mapping the global food ecosystem, one bite, one voice, one story at a time. Today, we ask, what if our food system isn't just vulnerable to climate change, but essential to solving it? To help us explore that question, I'm joined by Sam Cass, chef, policy strategist, and author of The Last Supper. From his time in the White House to leading food diplomacy on the global stage, Sam has spent his career making the case that food belongs at the center of climate conversations. In this episode, you'll hear why the future of everyday foods from coffee to rice is under threat, how policy, culture, and consumer choices all intersect in the food climate equation, and what it will take to build a real food movement that can shift both politics and palates. We'll also touch on a surprising truth: why even a fast food giant like McDonald's might hold clues to a more sustainable food future. So if you've ever felt that your grocery list and global systems are worlds apart, this conversation will show you just how deeply they're connected. Let's get into it.
The idea came from a set of conversations really around how to start connecting the issues of climate change and food and agriculture. And it was around COP21, where there's a lot of anticipation of a big breakthrough, which we ultimately did get. But food and ag was just not on the agenda in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, starting to learn about some of the impacts the climate was starting to have on our food system, where experts were predicting that the system would go because of climate over, you know, decades and decades. And so the first time I did the meal, it was around our kids and our grandkids and what we're leaving for them to eat, essentially, and to try to make an emotional connection to these issues that I think people don't really understand what's at stake when they talk about climate change. They don't really get how it's going to impact them. All they hear is about like energy policy and oil and gas. And, you know, you're a regular person working a job or two and raising your kids. Like, you don't have time to think about that. And so it's an effort to try to have people understand why they should care and what's at stake for them, and help policymakers and leaders understand that food and ag needs to be a core part of a solution set, both from because of the role the system has in driving climate change and environmental degradation, the impact that climate change is having on the food system itself, and the potential of the system to actually solve many of these challenges. And so that was the impetus behind the first one. And honestly, like, it just sort of took on a bit of a life of its own. Like, somebody would be at the one, and then they'd ask me to do it for their board or their organization, and then I'd do it there, and then somebody there would ask me to do it. So I've ended up doing, I have no idea how many of these Last Supper dinners, but dozens and dozens and dozens. I have no idea.
So let's go back to the first one. Where was that? And what was on the menu? And who was there?
So that was in Paris. And it was a total disaster, actually. It was at the ambassador's residence in Paris, which is this incredible, like, state. It's like, it's insane. And she hosted this huge gathering of, I don't remember how many people, 200 people or something, of very senior, kind of influential people who were there for COP.
At the height of the Paris climate talks, Sam Kass cooked a dinner that cut through politics in a way no briefing ever could. In a room filled with presidents, prime ministers, and global power brokers, he served a menu built from foods that climate change is already destabilizing. Coffee, chocolate, wine, seafood, grains, turning each course into a quiet warning. Rather than overwhelm leaders with data, he let the ingredients speak. The disappearing habitats behind a piece of fish, the rising temperatures threatening a glass of wine, the unstable rainfall patterns imperiling the grains on their plates. It was diplomacy through flavor, a visceral reminder that the climate crisis isn't theoretical, but deeply personal, touching the foods that shape cultures, economies, and daily life. That Paris dinner became the seed for his Last Supper series, a blueprint for making world leaders feel the future, bite by bite.
And I kind of did it a bit late, like I was sort of late to the game. And so a lot of the big chefs in Paris were booked up because I need a partner. If you don't have any infrastructure or team, or you just don't show up and cook a 200 meal dinner by yourself, right? So I reached out to a lot of the big chefs, but they were all booked. And so there was like this, like apparently a very good restaurant, although I'd never eaten there. It was a very small restaurant. And so I asked them to help if they would sort of help me with the dinner, which they were very excited about. And it didn't come to find out that, like, until that day, that the biggest meal that they ever done was for like 60 people or something. And I was like, oh shit, like 200 something is a very different animal.
What was their takeaway from the menu that they experienced?
I hope that people, when they experience one of these, and hopefully then too, that they come away with a sense of urgency, a sense of ambition about what's possible, and an increased awareness of the role that food and ag has to play in solving climate. Like, you're just not going to solve climate change unless you solve food and agriculture. So it hits pretty heavy. Like, it's intense.
So it was scallops and what else?
Well, the list is long. And that dinner now is 15 years ago. So I have no idea what specifically was on the menu. Wait. But the list is coffee, wine, chocolate. And these are things, I think the right way to think about these ingredients is that they'll be in precipitous decline over time and become increasingly more expensive.
Climate change is rapidly shrinking the narrow climate sweet spots needed to grow coffee, chocolate, and wine. Scientists project that by 2050, the land suitable for high-quality coffee could drop by up to 50%, while more than 60% of wild coffee species, the genetic backbone of future crops, are already threatened with extinction. Cocoa is facing similar pressure, with major West African regions expected to become too hot and dry to sustain production. Even wine grapes, which are extremely sensitive to temperature shifts, are predicted to lose up to 56% of their current growing regions under high emission scenarios. These mounting stresses are already being felt in real time. Global coffee prices surged by roughly 40% last year due to weather-driven crop losses, and cocoa prices hit record highs as yields plummeted. In short, climate change isn't just altering our environment. It's quietly endangering the future of our most cherished indulgences.
It's not that I'm saying that literally there will be no chocolate on the face of the planet, but it's really only going to be a very luxurious good over time. I think caviar. I think that's where chocolate is going. So coffee, wine, chocolate, shellfish and crustaceans of all kinds, stone fruit like peaches, plums, etc., nuts, pistachios or almonds. So that's like the macros of those kind of key big crops. But then there's regional disruptions playing out all over the place because plants and animals are basically migrating north and south. And so like certain communities that have been reliant on the crab fishery or peaches or whatever, like those are going to move. And so the economic and cultural disruption that's going to come from this is quite profound. And then there's the big commodities like rice, especially, but or soy, you know, rice, basically it's like a 10% decline on average for 1 degree of warming. And so, you know, 3.5 billion people, eat rice every day. And for many people, it's like the main thing they eat. And as price of rice goes up, the food insecurity from disruptions of a crop like that, same is true with wheat, by the way, is quite profound. It's not like rice is going to go away, but yields will be impacted. And that means prices will increase. And so when you're feeding, you know, the lower income populations of the world that have no extra disposable income, like that kind of even small increases in price lead to massive amounts of food insecurity. And that leads to, you know, forced migrations and political instability and conflict. And so when you start to look at those, that gets pretty intense.
So from where I sit, when I talk about one bite is everything, we're looking at what's on the plate and how it's connected to the rest of the world. In a lot of ways, and one of those ways is the environment. How did you come to this, sort of the pairing of food and climate, which it's sort of one track and there are plenty of other ones, but I'm just curious, both on the food and agriculture side, you know, what they were doing before you started doing this, and similarly, any sort of observations about how the climate fight was proceeding. And I think you've done some personalization of that that maybe wasn't present before, but I'd love to hear, you know, sort of there's food and ag on one side and there's climate and the environment on the other, and you've connected those very deliberately. Tell me more about that.
It really started when I was a young cook and I was training in Vienna, and I got sort of dressed down by not making a dish with enough butter in it by the sous chef who was training me. And it made me start asking a couple of key questions around what's the implications of the food that I'm putting on this plate. And I started grappling with the implications of those decisions on the health of the people who are consuming it. And once you ask that question, you have to ask, like, well, what's the implications on the land that it's producing the food and the people who are producing it and the environment that sustains us? And once you ask those two simple questions, it doesn't take long to realize, wow, we got some really big problems that are rooted in how we feed ourselves. And, you know, I basically decided to dedicate my life to trying to solve them. So the connections they're not hard to make. It's quite inconvenient to make them. It's why it's called inconvenient truth, right? I would much rather not make the connection and just enjoy my ribeyes and be happy. And I think because of the inconvenience, a lot of people choose not to make those connections, but they are very real. And I hope more people do decide to kind of dig into this and try to make better decisions based on that understanding of the connection between food and climate change.
So fast forward from Vienna and getting scolded on your limited use of butter, you ended up in the White House as the chef there. And a lot happened beyond just cooking meals in your partnership with the Obamas. Tell me how that started.
That really started from my time cooking for them in Chicago. And I helped change how they were eating at home. And Michelle really saw the impact on herself and the girls and just in how they felt better and improved health. And we would talk for hours about what was going on and what she was experiencing in her own home, like the struggles she was having to feed her girls was true for the country. She actually writes about this in her book. We started dreaming about what we could do together. And if we got to the White House, we were talking about planting a garden and then doing a big health initiative.
The Obamas didn't just talk about healthier, more sustainable food. They redesigned the White House grounds and its national influence to prove what was possible. They planted the first major kitchen garden since World War II, installed a thriving beehive that produced more than 170 pounds of honey a year, and transformed the presidential kitchen into a model of local seasonal, low-waste cooking. With Sam Cass as both chef and senior policy advisor for nutrition, the White House became a living classroom. Food scraps were composted, kids learned to garden on the South Lawn, and school lunch standards across the country were rewritten through the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. Together, Michelle Obama and Cass championed a movement that stretched far beyond 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, expanding farmers' markets, pushing for clearer food labeling, and inspiring communities nationwide to rethink their relationship with food, sustainability, and well-being.
you know, we dreamt up the whole thing long before we got there. Yeah. And so we started laughing at ourselves because we didn't think he had a chance. You know, we didn't think the country was really ready for him. And thankfully, the country proved us wrong. We were very clear and very forceful about what we were trying to do. We were trying to do it in a way that could bring enough people along, right? Like, there's no food movement at all. Any talk of a food movement is total bullshit. And by the way, I still don't really think there's much of a food movement, but there definitely wasn't one back then. There was a bunch of critics, but they make not a movement. And so one we had to do was try to raise the awareness around the issue. Now everybody talks about food and health and to some extent food and climate. But back then, nobody was talking about that. Like, it was like, you know, a few advocates and some writers, but it wasn't like a main part of the kind of public discourse, and certainly wasn't an issue that had any space in politics. Like, it was not an issue that anybody voted on. So we had to, like, one, raise the level of awareness, try to start working on shifting the culture. Hyperpartisanship was really taking hold, and the backlash against the first Black first family was quite intense. So, like, it's funny to think about the things we worried about, considering what's happening now. So we tried to position it in a way that was very hard to attack strategically. And you could go back, and she gave a speech to the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which was represented all the food companies. And it is very forceful, that telling them they need to fundamentally rethink all the food that they're making, and that it's not food, and that it's basically killing people. Like, they had never been spoken to like that. And they were freaked out and felt extraordinary threat the whole time that we were there. Fought like hell. They're not fighting right now. You want to know why? Because they're not threatened by what's happening in Washington right now. There's no industry pushback because there's nothing happening. We were in a war with them. We found some opportunities to partner and do some things together. But behind the scenes, they were battling us and we were battling them. And sometimes not behind the scenes. Sometimes that was right out in the open. So, no, it was very strong. It was just, you know, I think part of the thing, and I write a lot about this in the book, that I think people overlook, that shapes far more than policy what ends up on our plates is our culture. It shapes our politics, it shapes our businesses, and it shapes our eating preferences. And so it's the hard, messy part, but a lot of the stuff that people would see as like light and fluff was very strategic, like going on Jay Leno and making him eat a vegetable pizza, or doing a thing with LeBron or a thing with Beyonce. That was all like, yeah, it felt fun. But that was to try to take these values and insert them in the culture through the carriers of culture. And, you know, that's the bedrock of change.
What would it look like if we had a real food movement? I know we have MAHA. And like you said, the industries aren't particularly frightened about what's happening in Washington right now, but we don't have a food movement. What would it look like if we did?
We've had a cultural shift that's been underway for a long time before us. I think we were able to dramatically accelerate it. And so I think that has to continue. And I think turning into a movement means you're turning into a political movement where you have elected officials campaigning and winning and losing in part by what they believe government should be doing around food. And that's going to look like political engagement at every level, the state and local, and then in the federal, where voters and their top 10 issues would say, I care about food policy. Really, the top five, which it never, a single poll ever has ever shown up anywhere. And so it needs to be part of what we care about and what we vote on. So that's like the political version. And I think that also then translates into consumer movement, which is really making decisions on what products and foods we eat based on these values around better health and environmental sustainability. And that's not happening at all. It's just not. Like, it's happening in pockets, mostly on the coast. There's plenty of small brands or utopic farms, like the ones I shop at, that are super expensive, but I still hold my values. So I'm willing to spend $40 on a chicken because I care about it. But in terms of the mass market, that's not happening at all. And so that has to shift. If we want things to shift, we need voters to vote on this and consumers to purchase on it. And that's really the foundation of what a movement starts to look like.
And they start to feel some urgency about it. And how is the connection between ag and climate? Do you think that's elevating that sense of urgency?
Yeah, a little bit. I think it will be elevated as droughts persist, floods persist, fires persist. aquifers run dry. You know, the reality of the world is going to make us focus on it, whether we like it or not.
When our chocolate costs what caviar costs.
I mean, last year, chocolate was up 200% because of drought and climate. So I don't know where there's ways the industry mitigated it. They started putting like fillers in there to replace a bunch of the chocolate. But at a certain point, that's untenable. So I don't think we're as far away from those kind of cultural tipping points forced upon us than we think. I don't know what to root for there, right? Like,
yeah, a tipping point.
I don't want that to happen, but I think that's probably what's, you know, if I'm honest, what's necessary.
I mean, people have to find, you know, in any kind of movement, the what's in it for them kind of component, like what matters to me most. And if that is not going well, like I always find that people, you know, they have a baby or they have a health scare and then they want to find their local farmers and make sure that they're eating clean.
Yeah, totally.
I know that you have some new initiatives, but I'm sure that there were in the battles that you all fought in the White House, some real lessons that you learned in terms of how to move forward, how to bring people along. What can you share?
I think if you want to move the needle on something, you have to, in some levels, accept the reality for what it is. You don't have to like it. We need to kind of get over the outrage that this is how it is. Like, this is the current system as it stands. You know, a clear path about where we need to go and then work to figure out ways to pragmatically move in that direction as opposed to just stand like with your ideals and just say how shitty everything is, which is generally what most food movement stand-ins have done. And that part was really important to raise awareness. So like, you know, many of my heroes, Marion or Michael Pollan, whoever, like they played an important role in being like, hey, we got a problem here. But waving a flag that we have a problem is a very different thing than having a strategy to solve it. And that's what really what's been missing, frankly. And so when it comes to making the big kind of lever changes more systemically, I think understanding, and this is true at every kind of point of the value chain around growers, processors, manufacturers, retailers, and consumers, to really like understand what is motivating them. How are they incentivized to behave? What are their constraints? And what would it take to make them behave in a different way? What policies or cultural shifts or purchasing shifts or Wall Street changes or whatever it is along the value chain? Because a lot of things we ask like CEOs of food companies to do, like they would get fired for.
Like what?
You know, why don't you take out all of this and or spend a bunch of money on Regen Ag? Because like, well, then I would make no money. My profit margins would go to zero. Or very low, or my profit margins could go down in any way. And then you know what the board's going to do? They're going to fire them after their stock price drops by 20%. So oftentimes things that have harsh short-term business consequences are just like, when they hear that, they're like, you don't have any idea about how this works. You know, mm-hmm. I think many advocates sound like they speak a different language, like they're speaking gibberish when they're speaking to people running these companies, because they haven't done the work to try to understand, to sit in their seat and be like, okay, here's what they're grappling with. They're grappling with quarterly reports. They're grappling with a lot of volatility and a finicky consumer base and risk associated with this or that change, all these things. And I'm not saying it's an excuse for keeping things how they are, not at all. I'm just saying, if you want to effectively try to move things or figure out the right policy that is going to move it or the right coalition of advocates to try to, you know, move something forward, you got to really know how it really works. And that means, you know, accepting certain facts about the system that I don't like, that it's giant corporations feeding us. I don't think that's a good thing, but they're not just going to go away because I don't like them. You got to deal with them and you got to ask yourself, okay, reasonable to expect and how do we make progress? And then how do you build on that success? Then I think a lot of times change in the system is inherently incremental. Even the big things, giant, transforming school nutrition, big deal. 30 plus million kids every day, probably up to 15 million kids every breakfast getting breakfast that weren't getting it. Still incremental. In the big picture, small but very important change. And we just have to take that approach. And when we get a good win, we have to celebrate it and harness that momentum and let that momentum help us get to the next thing, as opposed to saying, it's all shit. Like everything we're seeing right now, none of that's real change that we're coming out of HHS at this point. It's all smokes and mirrors garbage. we have to call that for what it is. So I'm not saying celebrate anything, but if it's a meaningful impact, even if it's not the whole enchilada, or even if there's some problems with it, we can't be shooting ourselves in the foot.
What do you think about McDonald's investing $200 million in regenerative ranching?
Absolutely fantastic. Are you kidding me? Like, that's what it's all about. Like, do I wish everybody wasn't eating Big Macs every day? Yeah, for sure. But you know what? They are, and they will be. The scale of McDonald's is hard to comprehend. Like, I grappled with McDonald's, trying to get them to do a bunch of stuff. I moved them a long way, actually, but never got to a big announcement with them because there were some things they weren't willing to give on that we weren't going to tolerate. But in that process, I remember one of the guys I was talking to, they had just come out with a blackberry smoothie of some kind. I was pushing him, like, why is it taking you so long? They had these long timelines. He was like, to make that blackberry smoothie, it took us 2 years just to collect enough blackberry seeds to then plant enough blackberry bushes to get enough blackberries to make that blackberry smoothie. There weren't enough blackberries in the country to make that smoothie. And so anytime somebody of that scale is going to put real money to work to improve their supply chain. And by the way, I don't think the McDonald's consumer is clamoring for regenerative beef. I think they feel some big societal pressure and want to kind of get ahead of it, but also probably feel some pressure around supply chain security, volatility in that supply chain, that is the right thing to do. But it's not because people are coming in demanding regenerative beef.
McDonald's has pledged over $200 million to scale regenerative ranching across up to 4 million acres in 38 states, marking its largest sustainability investment to date. The company says the goal is to strengthen a vulnerable beef supply chain, improve soil health, boost water retention, and support ranchers as climate impacts intensify. With McDonald's serving 90% of Americans each year, the move carries real influence, but critics note that regenerative agriculture still lacks standardized metrics, making outcomes hard to verify. And while the headline number sounds big, spread over 7 years, it amounts to a relatively small per acre investment, raising the question of whether this is transformative change or strategic brand positioning.
So when a company does that, yeah, that's great. Like, I'm not under the hood enough to know all the details, and I'm sure there's a lot more to do. But who's going to say it's a bad thing? That's a good thing, and we should applaud that. We should keep the pressure on to do everything else they need to do. But somebody fought really hard in there to get that done, and I'm sure there's a bunch of business leaders in there who were like, this is stupid. Why would we spend this money? Let that drop to the bottom line, or let me invest that in a marketing campaign, or whatever. Then somebody in there fought hard to convince leadership that this is why that was important. So yeah, we need to reward that person or that group in there that got that done. And that's true. And anytime you see something, it's because there's just some small group of people who fight against generally the short-term business interests of that company to get something done. And we got to make that a win for them.
This isn't the first time that they've stepped forward into a space like this. They hired Temple Grandin to help make meat processing more humane. So it's an interesting pattern.
They have scale, and that's what matters. You know, like, it just matters.
Like you said, it's not going to go away because you might want it to with a big corporation. So,
and doing something perfectly for five people just doesn't matter to me. It's how you do something better for most people. That's what's way more important. I think that doing something perfect for five people is important to help us see what's possible, to help us point in the right direction. But what matters is affecting the people who need it most and affecting the most number of acres that we can. And so those efforts are really critical. They are really the most important.
Let's talk about where you're focusing your efforts now and on technology and what's happening in that space and what's the impact of that kind of effort.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a part of a fund called ACRE that focuses on human and environmental health through food and ag systems. It's trying to find emerging technology or companies across the entire value chain that can have a measurable and meaningful impact on these issues. And we're going to need new tools to solve these unprecedented challenges we face. I do think there's knowledge of how we used to do it that's valuable, but this idea that we can go back and harken back to some old time where everybody's on small family farms in these integrated systems, I just don't think that's how it's ever going to be. It's not possible to go backwards. The only way is forwards. And so the question is, what are the tools and new models, new technologies that could help us solve these challenges? And so we try to find entrepreneurs who are doing that. Sometimes it's very clear and obvious. And sometimes in terms of the impact, like a food waste company or a carbon sequestration company, very clear, black and white. Like this company is solving a very specific problem that would have a big impact. It's very easy to understand if it's successful, what that impact could look like. Those ones are easy. Other ones that are much more in the gray, right? It's a very powerful tool like CRISPR technology or AI or whatever the case may be. And depending on how it's used, could either be really, really good, like it could help reduce inputs and deal with drought or manage water better, whatever, taste better, more nutrient density, whatever it could be. Or it could be used to like spray a bunch of chemicals and take more profit from growers to guys in the middle. And so depending on what that is, how that's used will have a big impact on how the outcomes of those tools and technologies. And so those ones are complicated, whether you want to get involved in that. And sometimes we ask ourselves like, well, so there's risk here, right? This could be ultimately not a good thing, but will it be better if somebody who cares about these issues is at the table trying to help steer the company in a better direction? And most of the time, the answer to that is yes. So I'd rather sometimes take some of that risk that you might look back on this and be like, that wasn't good, but at least there's somebody there trying to make it okay. Because there's other forces, right, who they're just trying to maximize profit at all costs. And so that is kind of how the market works. And so if you're not have the right people in the room, that's what I think tends to happen. So it's trying to fight those fights to find the right companies and the right tools and then keep those companies and tools like on the right path. And then do it where it's financially successful so that it can actually get scale and have a broader impact. And I'll just say it's hard. You know, it's not easy.
I'm interested in this a little bit here, this sort of nexus, because I get it. We need more McDonald's of the world valuing better agriculture to protect their supply chain or to be able to impact farming and how it's done on a broad scale. And yet we have farmers who are aging out. You know, the old timers are aging out. And from what I see, most of the young farmers that are trying to get into the business or who are in the business, who are in their first generation, those are the farmers that are underscoring the importance of regenerative agriculture, of taking care of the land. And while it's not going back to the small family farm in every community, without those small family farms in our communities, I mean, I'm not getting soybeans, for example, from a commodity farmer that's taking up a lot of land and subsidies and water and using pesticides and GMOs and all of that. So I'm getting my chicken, you know, from a small family farm, paying more than I would pay at the supermarket for something that has a lot more value. So sure. I guess, you know, I don't know, where's the rub?
One of the greatest threats to our ability to manage climate is the loss of small and mid-sized farms. And right now, we are at existential risk of, I mean, look, there's been just massive loss of farms over the last 60 years, probably longer than that, if it depends on where you want to start. And we're right now on the precipice of massive consolidation, and that's not good. That is a existential threat to our ability to have enough diversity in our system to manage the volatility that we're about to face. I think those operations are critical. And I think part of why I emphasize the larger scale is that most people and most of our friends look at sort of big as evil, small as good. And while that might be true, I won't take a position on it one way or the other, it kind of doesn't matter. Because we need both. Small farmers need to be protected and supported. And I think the system is at much more risk and loss of vitality as we lose those small operators. And you also just have to deal with the fact that there are big players farming at scale. You can take your issues with it, and there are plenty of them, but they're also like providing a lot of calories, which are important. Like we take for granted our ability to feed ourselves, produce enough food for the planet. That's a very modern thing, right? This is a very new occurrence where famine and food insecurity, because of a lack of available calories, wasn't shaping life on planet Earth. This is a very new occurrence. And I think it's one that has created a bunch of unintended consequences, but it's not something we should take for granted. we need a little more humility. You know, the planet only at any given time has enough food on it to keep people alive for about 6 to 9 months, right? Like, that's intense to think about, especially looking at the challenges ahead. I've just become a little more humble in my critique or harshness of my critique about the problems, because it's going to be really challenging to navigate going forward. I think we're going to need all kinds of systems and approaches to weather it. And I think it becomes less clear. Like, it's not as, there's more nuance, I think, than often it's discussed.
Let's talk about what people listening can do, because I think we've talked about a lot of really big things that may make them feel more overwhelmed, not the least of which is the disappearance of, or really expensive trajectory of, our chocolate and coffee and wine. All three of those things I need to survive. And I'm always thinking about this, is how can we help people see a path forward and something that they can do to make an impact?
I think people have a really important role to play. Obviously, like, our food environments shape our decision-making, mean that, like, any of this is anybody's fault, or it's just up to the individual to solve this for themselves. But there's huge opportunity on a daily basis to have a massive impact. If there's a single thing to do to reduce your footprint, is to eat less meat. It's just what it is. I don't like that that's the case, but it's just true. I like meat. I eat meat, but I work to reduce the amount of meat that I consume, especially beef. Eat more chicken is a good way to go. Even if you're a diehard meat eater, just switch one night that you're having a steak to having some chicken, and the impact will add up. If you can go all plant-based for that day, even better.
And what you say, that is that because of industrialized beef, or I'm not sure which meat we're talking about.
The reality is, unfortunately, I think this is a bit of a misnomer. Grass-fed beef from a climate perspective, from an emissions perspective, is actually not any better than industrial beef. It is far better ecologically for the land and the health of the soil than industrial beef. But those cows grow slower and longer. And so overall, their footprint is the same, although the environmental degradation is less. And it really depends on where you are in the world. I was in Brazil a couple months ago, in deep in the Amazon, watching them clear the forest to plant grass to have grass-fed beef. One of the greatest ecological disasters of our kind, and they're not eating any soy or corn. So I think it depends a little bit on where you are. In the context of the United States, I choose grass-fed beef. I basically only eat grass-fed beef because I think it's better for the planet. But from a climate change perspective, it's really not better. There's going to be plenty of people who argue with me on that. But if you do the full life cycle assessment of these two animals, from just a greenhouse gas emission, I want to be very clear, it is about the same. So if you're going to eat beef, I would still eat grass-fed, but please don't think it's somehow got some small footprint, because it does not. And so the smaller the animal, generally, the more efficient it is in converting feed into protein and into food. And so I think it's a good rule of thumb to try to eat smaller down the chain, both with fish and with land animals. So that's one thing. The second thing is try to shape the culture around you to be one that values health and values the impact of the environment. And that can mean lots of things, but both starting in your home, but in your workplace or your religious affiliation in your church, synagogue, or mosque, or wherever you worship, in your workplace, just saying, hey, like, can we improve the health of these options? Or do we have any sustainability policy when it comes to our food that we're serving here? Even asking those questions and then organizing 10 other people in the office to ask those questions can have a really big impact on what's ultimately served and starting to shape the culture around you. That is really the shift that I'm talking about. So yeah, I can get Beyonce to do a song, but the real shift is going to be like that kind of shift. And then I think, like, we have to send a stronger signal to the market that we care about this. So I would buy blindly any product in whatever category you're shopping in, crackers or mayonnaise or whatever it is, that is making claims around sustainability and regenerative agriculture. There's a lot of greenwashing and there's a lot of bullshit, 100%. But right now, most of these companies don't think any of us care about this stuff. So we can show that, like, if you say that this is what it is, we're going to buy it. That's a very, very powerful signal to the market. Go in this direction. Then it'll be up to us to hold these companies accountable to be doing what they say they're doing and calling them out when they're not. An average shopper doesn't have time to figure out, like, what's real and what's not. And I don't think they need to. That's our job. But if you see it, buy it. Don't worry about whether it's real or not. Just buy that. I think it's a really important thing to do. And the last thing I'd say is vote. Please God, vote.
What we choose to eat isn't just a personal decision. It's a planetary one. Today's conversation with Sam Cass made that crystal clear. Food is both a frontline casualty of climate change and one of our greatest tools to fight it. From the White House garden to global diplomacy, Sam showed us that the path to climate resilience might just begin at our dinner tables. That's why this podcast and the Four Farmers movement matter. One Bite is Everything isn't just about listening. It's about turning these conversations into real life solutions. The stories you hear here are fueling small everyday actions that ripple outward, supporting farmers, reshaping culture, and rebuilding the food system from the soil up. If this episode moved you, help us grow the movement. Rate and review the show wherever you listen. It helps us reach more people and bring you even more guests who are building the future of food. Huge thanks to Sam Cass, first of all, and also to Sonia Dillon for co-production and editing, and to Russell Chapa for sound engineering, design, and original music. I am your host, Dana DePrima, and this is One Bite is Everything. I look forward to being together with you again next week. Until then, eat like it matters, because it does.